if someone has taken an illegal drug, 99.9% of people would straight away call an ambulance, freak out. They think this person's taken an illegal drug. You know, they could be overdosing, they could die, etc., right? But every single weekend in Australia, people go out to parties and someone passes out from drinking and they laugh about it. They say, oh, mate, don't worry, he'll sleep it off. He'll, you know, he'll be. But the reason why the person's passed out is because their brain is unable to stay conscious. And the reason why their breathing is slow is because their respiratory system is failing to cope with that level of alcohol in their blood.
In 1837, Horace Mann created the education system, a system at the time designed to pump out factory workers and professors, the same system that is still being used today in the 21st century. Now, Mann's system is backfiring. We are being moulded by the same industrial system that has existed for close to 200 years. That system delivers us into a digital economy that has no need of our outdated skills. This isn't our teachers' fault. This isn't the government's fault. This is due to a rapidly changing world full of technology and unforeseen circumstances. And us Gen Zs are caught in the middle. Welcome to the Driven Young Podcast, the podcast for stressed, overwhelmed young Australians, teaching you practical life skills you can implement now to set yourself up in life. And now your host, Byron Dempsey.
Welcome back to the Driven Young Podcast, and you have tuned in for an awesome episode today. With Season 3 kicking in, I really want to focus on doing more niche episodes around specific topics. So today we're covering a topic I've wanted to cover for a very long time, and that is drug and alcohol education. Today I'm joined by Tom Reynolds. He's a founder of the Independent Drug Education Australia. IDEA is Australia's leading and most trusted provider of independent drug education and training. They provide innovative and engaging workshops of the highest quality for the community on all alcohol and other drug issues. Tom Reynolds is the founder of IDEA and is passionate about reducing drug-related harm to the community through the provision of up-to-date evidence and science-based information. Tom was introduced to me via Brent Sanders, who did an episode on consent, and together him and I started an entire new podcast series on consent education. And just like Brent, Tom knows his stuff when it comes to this topic, but more importantly, he knows how to speak about it to a younger generation. In this episode, we cover all things drug and alcohol. We discuss why drug education doesn't work in schools, what percentage of people do drugs, the impact of alcohol, what to do if you see a friend in a drug-related situation, pill testing, how to make sure you stay safe, and so much more. As per usual, please DM me or Tom if you enjoy the episode. Your DMs mean the world to me and reminds me why I do this show. If you want to connect with Tom or get him to do a workshop, go to his website, www.inddea.com.au. The link will be in the show notes. And please consider leaving a quick review or rating on Spotify for the podcast. They just released this feature and it would really help me out. Now, over to Tom.
Tom, welcome so much to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, mate. It's great to be with you and great to see you doing some... you know, something passionate, there's something that you're passionate about, and also, you know, making a great change with young people.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We're just talking about Brent. So most people know the show, know Brent Sanders. Consent and Consequences is our second podcast. He introduced me to you, or he told me about you. You, similarly to Brent, go into schools and do workshops, not on consent, but on drug education, which is something I haven't covered. I don't think I've covered it at all on this podcast because it's such a hard one to cover. It's like, how do you find the right person to cover that? And so when I came across you, I was like, this is perfect. I'm very, very excited for this episode. So we're going to be talking a lot about drug education for young people. As you mentioned, it's not don't do drugs. We're going to be talking about how, when you're in a scenario where drugs are involved, how do you take control? How do you know what to do? I'm sure you'll get into it. Before we get into that stuff, I'd love to just really quickly know, what did you do after high school? Where was your head at? And like, what were the decisions that you were making at the time?
So I think that when I was sort of towards the back end of school, I very much fitted into the group of students who really didn't know what they wanted to do when they finished school. We had so many options and it was really tough. And then sort of towards the tail end of school, I had the idea of actually becoming a police officer. But through a range of different experiences that I had, and also probably some discouragement from my family and friends, mainly concerned about my safety, you know, because it's a risky job. I didn't pursue that career and I actually took 6 months off after school to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do, and I just worked for 6 months. And then I went into to study teaching, so PE teaching in schools. And I think through a range of different experiences that I had on pracs, I sort of figured that, you know, teaching wasn't really the field that I wanted to get into. So I was lucky enough to, I guess, obtain the credit that I got from my teaching to go and study sort of like a health-related degree. And it was during that time when I was doing my undergrad and my master's that I became, I guess, a lot more aware of how much of an issue that drugs was in society. And this wasn't, I guess, an academic point of view, but it was from, I guess, the fact that this was around the time when there was a lot of media attention given towards alcohol-fueled violence. There were, you know, a range of different, you know, legislative changes that came in looking at that. And also, I think a lot of people who work in these types of areas, there's something personal that happens to them, which, you know, sort of makes them think, look, I need to do something about this. So, and that was my situation as well. So my closest friend from school almost 10 years ago died in a drug-related incident. And I thought, you know, look, I'm looking at this at university. I did some work up at the hospital that I was working at, that I was studying, that was part of my studies. There was that personal situation that I was in, and also it was the fact that I heard a lot about it from the media, and I thought, look, whatever we're doing with drug education is not right. So I think I started off just writing out facts, figures, information, things that I'd heard, read, etc., all about drugs, and I ended up with this massive document that I decided to, that I wanted to present to young people. But I think that I really started off with the, I guess the mindset of, look, we need to tell young people, don't do drugs. Drugs are bad and they're harmful. Stay away from them. Just say no. And I think that I thought that maybe we're just not shouting that message loud enough. Right. So I very much fitted the mold, at the start of an anti-drug campaigner. But I had a great conversation with a student early on when I started doing workshops. The students came up to me at the end, and I thank her to this very day. She said, look, you speak really well, but everything you've told us, we already know.
Right.
We need to know what to do when things go wrong. We need to know how to respond, how to look after our mates. And that was a bit of a light bulb moment for me, because I thought to myself, you know, back to my friend who sadly passed away, I thought she got the same messages that all of her friends did. But, you know, tragically, some people do use drugs, and you know, and they're harmed by those drugs. Mm. And I think that what I learned from that experience was that it'd be great if no one used drugs.
Right,
that'd be wonderful. But the reality is that some people do, and we need to know what to do and how to look after those people when things go wrong.
In Australia, I'd say the reality is most people do. Young people, whether it's, you know, just trying it at a party here or getting very deep into it, I think everyone knows someone who's deep into it or has tried or done things. It's just a part of, I guess, very part of the Australian culture. So the message you say, don't do drugs, you know, it's been around for a while, exactly as you say. We've all heard don't do drugs, but it's not realistic.
Yeah, and everyone has taken drugs at some point, because everyone has had medicines and caffeine. Yes. They're both drugs, or both, you know, drug categories.
Panadol.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, one of the first messages that I actually go through with young people is I ask them, how many people do you think have done illicit drugs? Mm. So illegal drugs, drugs like cannabis, ecstasy, methamphetamine, etc. And the vast majority of students think that most people have done it. But if you look at the statistics, it's fairly clear that actually most young people don't use illicit drugs.
Right.
And that's interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, because you can straight away tell that a significant proportion of the information that young people receive about drugs is from the media, because there is this narrative that drug use is exploding, it's an epidemic, it's out of control as such. And also it's interesting because a lot of young people think that if I'm not out on the weekend doing drugs, then I'm at odds with everyone else. There's something wrong with me that I'm missing out. Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's really important for young people to know that if they are not using illicit drugs, they are not in the minority.
Mm.
They are part of the majority.
Mm.
It's obviously different with alcohol. We know that, you know, depending on which year we look at in terms of years 7, 8, 9, 10, the majority of high school students have used alcohol, but the majority aren't going out binge drinking on the weekends, etc. So again, like, yes, we've all taken medicines and caffeine, but actually it's really important for young people to remember that if they're not, I guess, using illicit drugs, not drinking regularly, then they fall into the majority.
And I think that's where the whole conversation around peer pressure comes in. Mm. You know, it's like, oh, well, I want to be like everyone else. I want to fit in with the cool kids. I want to, you know, be like them. It's like, well, because I didn't know that either. I would have guessed like 70%, maybe 70, 80% have either done drugs, maybe 20% do drugs regularly, illicit drugs, of course. But as you're saying, the numbers don't highlight that.
Yeah, and I think that it's, as I said, it doesn't. Every day we hear about some sort of drug related story. It doesn't matter whether it's someone drugs being seized, someone being arrested, pill testing, decriminalisation. We hear about illicit drugs all the time, and this feeds into the idea that everyone does them. But I mean, as I said, it's important for them to realise that they're not missing out if they're not doing drugs.
Yeah, which is, I mean, maybe that's the first, is that the first point you always get across in your workshops?
That's one of the first points that I make, and I think also one of the really big messages that I do try and get through to young people is that illicit drugs do receive a huge amount of media attention, unquestionably on a daily basis, but what receives almost no attention is alcohol, and that is the drug that we need to be concerned about with young people, because if we look at deaths, hospitalizations, if we take out tobacco, which kills more people than all other drugs combined, many of the about 6,000 deaths in Australia every year occur in young people. But alcohol receives very little attention at all.
Yeah, and out of those 6,000, what are you saying 6,000 are alcohol-related?
About 6,000 alcohol-related deaths every year in Australia.
Right. That's huge.
And some of those are acute situations, so people dying in, from alcohol poisoning, car accidents, etc. And a lot of them are from, the long-term impacts of alcohol, so cancers, etc.
Yeah. So like a car accident, if they were drunk drivers, is that an alcohol death?
Yes. If alcohol plays a contributing factor, yes.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a really important one to understand, isn't it? Because a lot of people are going, weed doesn't kill nowhere near as many people as alcohol. Yeah, why is weed illegal, but alcohol is legal?
Yeah, that's...
And then people talk about caffeine as well.
Yeah.
And say, look at the effects of caffeine long term. I'm not even sure. I have caffeine. I had a coffee this morning.
Yeah, I mean, like you give a few cans of Red Bull to a small group in the population, or, a few strong cups of coffee, and there'll be people who have seizures from that. So there's no such thing as a safe drug. There never has been, there never will be, because there'll always be a group of people who respond severely and adversely to every single drug. It's a zero-sum game as such, yeah.
And to clarify, alcohol is a drug?
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because I think most people don't even consider that.
Yeah, and it has a different language. So a lot of people will say, I'm addicted to drink.
Yeah, yeah.
When really alcohol is a drug.
Right.
Yeah.
You're addicted to drugs.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I often hear is people say alcohol and drugs, but we don't say fruit and apples,
right?
Because apples are fruits.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very subtle, but it's a very powerful message that alcohol is not really a drug, but therefore not overly harmful. Yeah.
Subtle is a good word. Subliminal, almost subtle messaging that goes into your subconscious thinking, oh, alcohol's not a drug. I'm fine.
Yep.
And as we know, alcohol's the biggest killer. Aside from tobacco.
Yeah. In terms of drug-related deaths, absolutely. Alcohol kills about 2 to 3 million people throughout the world every year.
Wow.
Tobacco, about 7 to 8 million people.
Yeah.
It's tragic that most people who die from tobacco, at least in the near future, will be in developing countries as well.
Yeah.
The tobacco industry has, I guess, very much lost the fight in developed countries like Australia, who have really good tobacco control programs. But in other countries which they're able to be exploited by the influence of tobacco companies, we see tobacco deaths in those countries rising, unfortunately. Right. Yeah.
Did you see the New Zealand law?
Yes, I did.
On tobacco?
Yes, I did.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think that...
Well, to clarify the law for the listeners... Didn't she, Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand Prime Minister, just announce that tobacco is illegal?
From memory, what it is that anyone who is 14 years of age and under will now not be able to legally purchase tobacco.
Ever.
As in tobacco products, which is cigars, cigarettes, etc. Now, I think that moving towards a smoke-free society is fantastic. I think that's certainly a wonderful thing. And there are certain countries in the world which are on track to do that, such as Sweden, because they allow the population to consume something called snus, which is a pasteurized, smokeless form of tobacco, and their rates of lung cancer is a slither of what other comparable European countries are.
Because they get to maintain the habit.
They're still
smoking and kind
of
feeling that.
It's a smokeless form of tobacco. So people put the it's a pasteurized form of tobacco, but they're not burning it. Because the vast majority of smoking related deaths occur because people set the tobacco on fire burn it, that generates smoke.
Gotcha.
That smoke generates the carcinogens, which causes cancer and all the other things like heart disease.
It's not the tobacco itself.
Well, it's the burning processes, tobacco. And also the fact that when the tobacco is when it's fermented, that's also when it generates some of the carcinogens as well. So what kills the vast majority of people from which are tobacco-related deaths throughout the world occur because people are smoking the tobacco. Mm. Nicotine still has harms, of course, but we significantly reduce the risks of nicotine when we remove the smoking element of it.
Okay,
which is why, for example, you know, smokers who switch to things like nicotine replacement therapy, things like gum patches, lozenges, they're still getting the nicotine, but they're not getting the smoke.
Mm.
People smoke for the nicotine, they die from the tar.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's where it's like, it allows you to, instead of going cold turkey, you can still get that hit of nicotine without doing the smoke, which is, as you mentioned, the dangerous part.
The vast majority of people who are smokers and who have tried to quit have failed.
Mm.
There are people who go to their doctor who have peripheral arterial disease, and their doctor says, you need to quit smoking. And they can't quit smoking, and they have to get their leg or their arm amputated.
Wow!
And that's how powerful, the withdrawals are. Nicotine replacement therapy also doesn't replace the ritual of smoking. So people actually going out having a cigarette, it doesn't administer the nicotine fast enough, and it's a short acting drug. Gets into the brain, out of the brain quickly, which is why people need to go out for cigarette breaks frequently as such. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and to the listeners, I've never smoked a cigarette before, nicotine cigarette, because I heard this stuff when I was younger, and I was like, well, I can't get addicted to something I never try. Mm-hmm. That was always my logic. That's always been my logic. You know, I think my dad said he had like one cigarette, and he was like disgusting. He's never had one since, and that was 25 years ago or whatever.
Yep.
My mom said she tried it once or something, and it was gross, or I don't know. And I was like, well, if I don't try it, I can't get addicted to it. And that's always been my logic. But something that I see that's so common for young people in Australia is everyone knows, especially my generation, everyone knows smoking is bad. There's no, oh no, but it's cool, it's not that. No, everyone knows it's bad. We're taught that, it's very obvious. However, when people go to parties, they have just, you know, they'll have a cigarette just at a party. But then, I've been out of high school for 5 years now. Those guys who are having cigarettes at parties, they're now smoking a pack a week, a pack a day, whatever it is. Because they go to a party, then 1 week they have two at a party, then the next week they have three, and it builds up. And over a 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, suddenly they become actual smokers.
Yep. Yeah, and it's what's frustrating is that the tobacco industry has had a really long it's well known the tobacco industry, even though they are not legally allowed to do this, have targeted throughout history young people.
Mm.
People who are not even legally allowed to smoke.
Mm. Which is 16 here?
It depends, like, different, you know, state legislation, etc. But targeting the tobacco industry has targeted young people over a long period of time, and the vast majority of people who do take up smoking take it up when they are very young,
because they're gullible, vulnerable, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and again, they think that if I'm not doing it, then I'm missing out.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of young people say to me that you know, oh, that's not true. Like, most people have tried a cigarette or do use illicit drugs, etc. I know, you know, out of my 10 friends, you know, eight of them have done it. And I will always say, yeah, look, out of your 10 friends, but if there's 200 students in your year group, probably 150 of them have not done it.
Yeah.
So,
and keep in mind, that's because your 10 friends feed off each other. So if two people do it, then another two people do it because you're in the same friend group.
Yeah.
And you're in a little echo chamber of your friend
absolutely.
Group.
And a lot of people think peer pressure, and I'm not saying that doesn't have an influence, but really what actually it comes down to is peer preference. So is often, it's not so much what your friends are doing when you're around them, it's who your actual friends are as such.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I would just say don't try cigarettes. It's worked out well for me. Yep. I've never had any temptation or craving. Yep. Just avoid them if you can. But I mean, obviously we mentioned at the beginning, we know realistically not everyone's going to avoid them. Mm. And getting cigarettes long-term are the biggest killer. But if we talk about other drugs, party drugs, I guess, is probably the term, you know, LSD, all that sort of stuff you were talking about before, You like to talk about how what to do when you're in a situation like that girl mentioned. What do I do if I'm in a situation where someone's greened out or someone's passed out, or all this sort of stuff, which is a situation that chances are you're going to encounter in your life at a party, whether it's a close friend or you see it happening. And I think that, you know, with the right education, you could save lives if you know what to do.
Yeah, I think the first thing to mention is that I don't know about the vast majority, but a significant proportion of people will never see illegal drugs in their lifetime, and they'll never see someone use cannabis, use ecstasy, LSD, etc., right? But almost everyone will have to look after someone who's drunk at some point in their life.
Yeah.
I think that this is a really big issue where we have people, for example, who are... And look, certainly illegal drugs in of themselves can be toxic and harmful, etc., but if someone were using a drug like, for example, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and that person was to suffer a seizure, go unconscious, pass out, etc., if someone has taken an illegal drug, 99.9% of people would straight away call an ambulance, freak out. They think this person's taken an illegal drug. You know, they could be overdosing, they could die, etc., right? But every single weekend in Australia, people go out to parties and someone passes out from drinking.
And they laugh about it.
They say, oh, mate, don't worry, he'll sleep it off. But the reason why the person's passed out is because their brain is unable to stay conscious. Yeah. And the reason why their breathing is slow is because their respiratory system is failing to cope with that level of alcohol in their blood. So I think that illicit...
Drug overdose.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. And I think that the most important thing that any person, young person can do is to not be afraid to call for help if something does go wrong. Because I would say the biggest, I guess, issue that I find working with students is that they don't want to call for help because they think that the police will turn up, their parents will find out, et cetera, et cetera. They'll get into trouble, they'll get arrested, all of those things.
Ultimately, like, paramedics don't care about anything legal. They just want to save the person.
Yeah, and even that is the case with police as well, yeah. If they turn up. Most of the time, the police don't turn up to drug-related overdoses, including alcohol. That wasn't always the case. Police would, a long time ago, turn up and look for evidence of other crime. But because drug-related deaths became so high, a lot of people thought... there were a certain amount of peak bodies in Australia who said, look, this needs to stop because people are not calling an ambulance in fear of the police turning up. But, I mean, there's a couple of things. First of all, most of the time the police don't turn up. But even if they do... Their objective is to make sure that everyone is safe. Mm. Their objective is not to start arresting people, you know, finding out who supplied who, etc. They're there to make sure that people are safe.
Mm. Which is, as you mentioned, a really good first point. I'll even give you an example because I do like how you brought this up. Like, look, there are drug overdoses, but something that we'll deal with is alcohol. And I know people probably disagree, but like, I really don't like the drinking culture in Australia. I think that the way they romanticize, like throwing up is like, yeah, you're good on you, mate. You've thrown up. Like, no, what the hell? I haven't thrown up in so long. And like, I've been partying a lot since we moved out into this place. We've been hosting heaps of things. I'll do 3 parties back to back because I just drink enough where I'm like, I'm feeling buzzed, and then I just go to sleep. I wake up at 9 o'clock. I do a full day's of work. I can do that again and again and again because I'm not wiped out because I'm so hungover. But I mentioned I had a party on, what day is it today? It's Monday, last Friday. And it was a classic. This guy just got... I don't think I've ever seen someone so drunk. I don't know where it came from. He was fine. He was on the ground. He was slurring his words. He could barely speak. We were there giving him water. We were lifting his legs up. We had to drive him back to his parents and make sure he was okay. I almost called the ambulance. And that was just like, it's just so unexpected. And again, like I didn't call the ambulance because everyone's like, he's fine and fine. But I was like, I was on the edge. If it was a drug, if it was, you know, a different type of drug, an illicit drug, I probably would have called an ambulance straight away.
Yeah. A lot of people don't. Because, I mean, and a lot of this has to do with the huge influence that the alcohol industry has essentially blinded the public to the harms of alcohol. I think that, to be honest, we'll look back in 20, 30, 50 years' time and think, how did we allow alcohol advertising, the fact that, you know, I mean, the influence that the drinks industry has is enormous.
It's saying like the sports bets ads, the gambling ads. Like, everyone loves sports bets ads.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the whole reason they do it. They know you love it. So that you use their platform.
Yeah, and most adults in Australia drink alcohol. And the drinks industry knows that people don't want to face their drinking. They don't want to hear that alcohol is harmful. And the connections that the drinks industry has to the media, to the government, etc. And this has been well documented in other countries as well. Where any time that, you know, some proposal is put forward about, you know, for example, raising the price of alcohol, banning alcohol advertising, stopping bulk purchase discounts, all of these things which we know reduce total alcohol, you know, total alcohol consumption and therefore, you know, alcohol harms. Every time we have a discussion about that, we get these, you know, we get these outcries from the drinks industry saying, oh, it's a nanny straight, punishing the responsible drinker, you know, it's over-regulation, all of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I get it. Like if an announcement came out saying alcohol is going to get more expensive, my first reaction would be, freaking hell, it's already, you know, $18 cocktails or whatever. It's already too expensive. But as you mentioned, if it's long-term, if you're saving lives through it.
Yeah, and look, most of the harms from alcohol come from, as in, if we look at, for example, particularly the acute harms of alcohol. We know that about 70% of all alcohol sold goes to a very small proportion of dependent drinkers. Mm. And this is where the perverse message that the drinks industry says on every single bottle, it says enjoy responsibly. When in fact that one whole purpose of drinking alcohol is to dissolve responsibility. Mm. Mm. But also, the drinks industry rely on people almost drinking themselves to death. Mm. If we didn't have that really heavy subset of group of people, the drinks industry would effectively go out of business. Mm. And really the answer to that is to increase the price of alcohol. We floor price alcohol. We say, for example, I mean, it's ridiculous that people can go to a bottle shop and purchase, you know, 4 liters of wine for $10, you know, $2.50 a liter. So they're getting, you know, 7 standard drinks for, you know, about $2.50. Mm. So every standard drink is about 40 cents or something like that. Now, if you were to say, for example, well, actually one standard drink is now going to be a dollar, it's going to be a dollar tax. All of a sudden that now casts that amount of wine goes to, you know, $30 or something like that. And what that does, it reduces consumption among young people because they have low disposable income, and also it reduces harm among the dependent population because you're pricing out cheap booze. Mm. And this has been well documented in other countries as well, which have increased the price of alcohol, and the drinks industry has actually become more profitable because there's greater profit margins in expensive alcohol.
Right, right. There you go, win-win.
But it's very easy just for them to roll their arm over and to keep making money.
And it's very difficult. I mean, especially in Australia, I can't see that ever happening. I can't see anyone ever being... And whoever pushes it through is going to be hated. Yep. Whoever is the person to say, hey, here's a tax on alcohol or whatever it is, everyone's going to hate that person. Yeah. And I'd be annoyed as well. I'd be like, ah, oh, freaking hell. Like, I don't... You know, I drink, but not reliant on it. But it's just inconvenience. But I guess, as you mentioned, for the everyday...
People who are... Generally speaking, individuals who are responsible drinkers who go out to purchase alcohol in licensed venues, they aren't impacted by the increased price of alcohol because they're already consuming it above what would that floor price would be.
Right.
So, I mean...
You're talking about the goon bags, which are like really, really, really cheap.
Correct. Instead of cheap bottles of vodka, etc.
Right.
And there is some evidence now from the Northern Territory who have implemented a minimum price on alcohol that it is reducing alcohol-related harm.
Great. Yeah. There you go. But I mean, I guess the thing is, like, it seems obvious in this podcast because we're like, what, 26 minutes in now? Yep. But it's hard to get Australians' attention for this long in terms of the media. All they'd see was a headline.
You know, correct.
XXX is going to increase alcohol prices like this. And in the fine detail, it says, oh, the average person won't actually be impacted. It's just the cheap, very, very, very cheap, which is the low disposable income people who are typically drinking themselves.
And this is actually not only an issue with drugs in general. In public health, it is extremely difficult for scientists and people who work in public health to dispel, not to dispel, but to distill a huge amount of scientific information and their reasoning and logic into short sound bites.
Yeah.
Not only because it's difficult to do that, but in many situations it can be, in a way, dishonest to, you know, make something as, I guess... to be perfectly certain about that, because you know, in science and in public health, there's when we do research, There's very little certainties. We work on probabilities as such. So it's very difficult to, you know, get all that information together and put it into a, you know, into a soundbite.
It's, I mean, it's so much easier for the media to just go bang, alcohol is getting increased, whatever the headline is. And then you, all you see is the headline, you don't even read the article, and you're sending it to your friends, getting annoyed, or the group chat, all that sort of stuff. And you can see why that's not going through right now in Australia. But I mean, it's good to see the Northern Territory is doing it, and other countries are doing it. Sweden, not with alcohol, but with
Providing people with Sweden's providing the public with a safer alternative. And this is, you know, potentially where low alcohol products have a role, or non-alcoholic products have a role in Australia. I mean, there are certain companies now which are exploding in growth in Australia because they're selling non-alcohol products. People still want the taste of their beer, their wine, their rosé or whatever, but without the harm attached with alcohol.
It's like a decaf. It's like a coffee.
Yep.
It's like if you want to get off coffee, just get a hot chocolate or decaf so you maintain the habit. You're almost tricking your brain onto like a placebo, but there's no caffeine in there. And the same with like nicotine things you smoke, but it's not real smoke or something. It's like
snus. It's a pasteurized smokeless form of tobacco. So it's placed in the mouth, and the nicotine's absorbed in there, as opposed to burning it and then inhaling the smoke.
Right, right.
So the root of the way the drug gets into someone's body is critical in terms of its harm. So the, for example, someone, so, and this is, and this is a major issue when drugs get banned. So for example, if we go back 100 years, people in Australia were able to smoke opium, right? Now, when opium was banned and restricted, people switched to heroin and they started injecting heroin, and heroin deaths went through the roof. And then when heroin was cracked down upon, people switched to fentanyl. And fentanyl is a much more potent opioid. But the reason why deaths from heroin went through the roof is because people were given the less harmful version, which is smoking opium as opposed to injecting heroin. So the way the drug gets into someone's body is critical in terms of how harmful the drug is.
Right.
So we know that, for example, injecting is, you know, intravenously is the most risky form of administration. But there are harms with everything. So, for example, burning anything and inhaling it is going to be bad for your lungs, your throat, your esophagus, etc., your mouth. But also injecting, you're not only getting the fact, you're not only getting the drug in a more potent form, but you are increasing your risk of, particularly if you're sharing needles, contracting risk of HIV, hepatitis, getting collapsed veins, all of those things as well. So the way the drug gets into someone's body has a really significant bearing on how harmful the overall harm of the drug is. So I think, I guess what I usually do is start off with some data around how many people use drugs and dispel that myth that, you know, if you are... If you're not doing drugs, then you're missing out.
Right.
So the first thing that I try and get through to young people is, if you're not using illicit drugs, you're in the majority.
Yeah.
Okay. Slightly different with alcohol, but still, if you're not drinking regularly, if you're not a binge drinker, you're in the majority. Okay. And this has changed a lot over time. So we've seen, for example, a massive drop in alcohol consumption among young people.
That's good.
Even though you wouldn't think that from the way the media, you know, it's the worst generation we've ever had, it's out of control and all that sort of stuff. Well, actually, a lot of young people are turning away from alcohol.
So. Well, a stat that I've used quite a bit is studies have shown in the past 10 years, the four precursors of mental health problems for young people used to be alcohol consumption, cigarettes, underage drinking, which is underage sex, and there's one other one, I forget what it was. And in the past 10 years, that's dropped by 50%. But at the same time, mental health has doubled. And so what's the, if it's not these four things, which is what the media often pushes, is it, you know, and we can't say for certain, but I think social media, that's when social media has come out and that's had a big play in terms of young people's mental health. And so exactly as you say, even if you think, oh, young people are taking drugs and drinking, no, it's never been this low.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that social media certainly has and is continuing to have a significant impact on young people's health. And I think that's because of a number of reasons. I think a large part of it is due to the fact that it's very easy to be someone who you're not on social media. And it's very easy for people to look at certain lifestyles and think, well, why don't I have that? You know,
it's a comparison thing.
Yeah. Someone will show a picture of themselves with their brand new car, you know, and someone will think, well, I wish I could afford that car or whatever it is. But they won't show the fact that they're now $100,000 in debt for it, that they don't actually own the car, no. If that makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
So it's I think young people really need to be aware of the social media as such is not the real world. It's very easy to be someone who you're not on social media.
It's just a concept to talk about quite a bit is wearing masks. Everyone's wearing different masks. They've got a mask when they're with this friend group. They've got a mask on social media, whatever it is. How often are you removing all the masks and it's just you? And I think it's becoming more popular as we've kind of, we've hit the peak, well, not the peak, but you know, social media is very normal now. When it's not new. It's very, very normal. Kids are, you know, 12 years old, they've had it their entire life. They're 16 years old, they've never had a life without social media. And so I think we're starting to go, all right, let's stop doing all this bull crap. Let's stop faking it. Let's try to be more authentic. I'm seeing more authentic creators out there, which is great, but it's still a huge problem.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, look, even if you just look at the like, I think a classic example is the number of friends that people have on Facebook.
Right, yeah.
I mean, someone will say, oh, look, I've got 2,000, 2,500 friends or 1,800 friends on Facebook or whatever. They would be really lucky if they had five really close friends in real life.
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them don't. And it's, do you know on Instagram you got your close friends list?
Yeah.
So like I've never really used it, but basically when you post a story, you can post it to all your followers and then you can have a close friends list, which is just like your 20, 30, however many you want of your close friends. And it's an interesting concept to me. It's like, why would you post something, you know, obviously unless it's like an inside joke or something, but it's kind of, it's interesting that that's even a feature. And private accounts, people have their main account and another private account, and the private account is where they post the real them.
Yep.
You know, they post like the silly, goofy photos that aren't, you know, the perfect lighting and all that stuff. And it's like, couldn't that be your main account?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or mix them together or something. But it's just interesting to me that those concepts exist.
Yeah. I mean, this would be before, I guess, before your generation, but the first social media web was MySpace.
MySpace, yeah, yeah.
And there was a function on MySpace where you could rank your friends.
Oh, really?
And publicly. So you would have, for example, down the bottom of your
page, I didn't know that.
You would have, like, you know, your friends, and it would say maybe like the total number of friends that you have. And of course, you're always more cool with the more friends you have. But then you would have, like, you know, for example, friend one, who was usually your girlfriend or your boyfriend dating at the time, or unless you had a fight, then they might drop back to number two.
Right.
But then you'd have, you know, like, and then if you push them back or out of the group, there'd be this, you know, oh, why'd you take me out? Yeah.
It's the same with Instagram. You see someone and it's like, oh, they removed their boyfriend's initials from their profile. And
then
you
look, what's going on there?
Oh, what's going on there? I look through. Oh, their boyfriend photos aren't there anymore.
They're single now.
Are they single? Are they broken up? What's happening? I don't even know who this person is. But for some reason, you're invested in a random person's drama. Yeah. Did you ever know Ask FM?
I've heard
oh, that was the peak. That was bad. That was like year 9 or year 10 for me. It was like this platform where basically you would post anonymously or publicly. You had an account and you could ask people questions and then they would answer them. So, you know, I could anonymously ask you, so who do you have a crush on? Or like, who do you hate the most? And people would answer, well, what are your thoughts on this person? And they could answer anonymously or publicly or whatever. And it was just like this horrible feed where everyone could have like their anonymous opinions and like bully through this thing. Yeah. And it was like the peak of like, I guess, toxic social media.
Yeah.
It was shocking. Like looking back on it now as an adult, going, oh my God, that was dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, I mean, social media is a tool. It's like many things. I mean, look, you know, it's like cars, for example. Cars, you know, they have a function, they serve a purpose. But, you know, 1,300 people every year die on the roads.
Yep.
So it's a tool. Like social media is a tool. Sure, it can be fantastic to keep in contact with people, particularly people who live, you know, in maybe overseas who you haven't seen or interstate or whatever or far away from you. But I really do think that social media is, I guess, it's, in like the slogans are that it's connecting people, but in a way it actually keeps people further away.
It does. And my argument to that, to agree with that, I guess argument to support your statement is basically they say it's, you know, you're more connected. But the thing is social media allows you to pull out of events and pull out of things so easily. And so people would rather than meet up and be connected, they just do it on text. Or rather than sort out the argument on the phone, they do it over text and you can't hear their emotion and their tone of voice and you can't, and then, you know, and you sit here for hours arguing and stuff. Yeah. And I've done all this. I'm not.
Yeah. I think we all have.
I can talk about this because I know it from my own experience and stuff. But yeah, it is for me. I mean, social media has changed my life. It's the whole reason you're here. Mm-hmm. All my listeners come from social media. Everything I do is social media. I work on social media like all the time. Yep. Funny enough, me and my roommate, now that we're living together, we've set limits on our phones. And so when you run out of the limit on Apple, it locks everything and a passcode comes up. Mm-hmm. Now, I've done that in the past, but usually I just put the passcode in. we've given each other our own passcodes.
Yep.
So I don't know what my passcode is, and I know his. So if we really need it for work or something, he can put it in. Mm-hmm. He hasn't had to yet. But it's good. It means, like, every time I go on social media, I'm conscious, oh, this is eating into my allowance almost. And it's meant that I am more efficient with my time.
Yes.
Because humans are lazy. As you mentioned, if you raise the price of alcohol, that's the only way to get people to stop buying alcohol, like force them to do it sort of thing. Mm. It's the same with that. If you give me a limit, then I'll have to, and I have no choice to stick to it, then I have to stick to it.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, just on that note of, alcohol, there. In public health, there is no such thing as perfect solutions. I mean, some people even argue that, for example, RBTs, which nobody in public health disagrees with. Mm-hmm. They all think that RBTs, so random breath testing, is a great thing that we should continue to have on the roads, because we know that, you know, the more someone drinks, the greater risk of having not only a car accident, but, you know, a serious car accident, right?
Well, in that scenario, I think it's not even them we care about. It's the fact that you could kill someone
else.
Other
people.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct.
So you're putting yourself in danger, but you're also putting other people in danger.
Yeah. But I think that even though people, no one disagrees with that. No one would, I mean, we wouldn't get rid of RBTs, for example, unless there was some way we could, you know, replace it as such. But, you know, even that, a lot of people argue, well, we don't have now that we have RBTs, instead of what people doing what they did many years ago, which was going out having four or five drinks, can you walk straight? Yeah, look, I can drive home, that's fine.
Yeah.
Now what people do is they save all their drinks up and have them on Saturday night, and they get blind drunk and they don't drive. So then you're changing the harm. So then there might be more people being admitted to hospital because they've, you know, instead of having four or five drinks and then driving home, they are now, you know, for example, having 25 drinks on the one night and, you know, passing out in the middle of a park or something like that.
You know what's interesting about drink driving? I think it's really done well in this generation. I'm not based on statistics. This is just based on what I've seen. I've never, ever seen anyone encourage drink driving. It's very, there's always got to be, oh, that's a designated driver.
Very socially unacceptable.
Yeah. Whereas drugs and getting blind drunk and passing out and throwing up, that's still socially acceptable, I'd say. But drink driving, that's where people go, nah, like, that's where they cut it. In my experience, I don't know if the statistics back that up.
Yeah, so look, I mean, certainly getting behind the wheel of a car when someone has had, you know, I mean, I would even argue that I think that people should drink or drive, not try and think, oh, look, I've had two drinks. Look, I'll probably be okay.
Right.
Oh, maybe I had that one. Was that two drinks? Or was that like a big glass of wine? Oh, that was a strong beer. You're treading a fine line. And I think that people should drink or drive. And when it comes to other drugs, however, like...
That actually is the case for the first 4 years of your license.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. You can't have any.
I was going to say, because I was like, that's what I did. But like, now that I got my falls, it's like you have one or two drinks, two usually max a night.
Yep.
And then that's it. But yeah, I mean, typically I usually just drink or drive anyway.
Yeah, but it's also very difficult because people are not measuring exact standard drinks.
Yeah.
They're not saying, oh, look, I've had, you know, exactly 30 mils and this was exactly this amount percentage, so I'm going to be okay at that particular time.
It's I was 1.3, but my body weight and my BMI is this, you know, he's bigger than her, she, it's like there's so many variables, it's almost impossible to like
absolutely
navigate.
It's much better to be safe and say, look, I'm going out and I'm drinking tonight, so I'm not driving.
And that's a great thing about Uber and, you know, all those companies. It has allowed you to be able to have everyone go out and everyone get drunk and then get home safely, which I've done heaps of times.
And I think that When it comes to drugs, however, as in like other drugs, like, I mean, the police generally test, it changes again state to state, but the police generally test for four other drugs on the road: cocaine, methamphetamine, MDMA, and THC, which is the stoning ingredient in cannabis. The problem is that the policy regarding mobile drug testing is not nearly as evidence-based as the alcohol policy is, because we know that the more someone drinks, the greater the risk of having a car accident. When it comes to, for example, like particularly something like THC and cannabis, there have been multiple studies that have come out which have really questioned whether someone being under the influence of THC or under the influence of cannabis does impair their driving ability. Now, of course... And there have been some studies overseas, for example, in the US, where people have, they've allowed, you know, the regulated access to cannabis. People switch from being drunk to being stoned. And obviously when someone's drunk, if they drive, They drive like they're race car drivers.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas when someone is under the influence of cannabis, they're often quite paranoid. They drive extremely slowly.
Right.
And so total deaths actually fell.
Because I've switched from alcohol to cannabis, because cannabis is now legal. So they go, well, rather than
in
get
some
drunk,
parts of the world, yeah.
Yeah, I might as well just get stoned.
Because a lot of people would rather be under the influence of cannabis than alcohol. The risk profile is certainly different. It's very easy to overdose on alcohol. It's very, 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 very difficult to overdose on cannabis.
Mm.
Cannabis does not contribute to the enormous social harm that alcohol does. The fact that alcohol is implicated in half of domestic violence, child abuse, sexual abuse, non-domestic violence, workplace absenteeism, traffic accidents, et cetera, et cetera. There have been three studies that have come out in the last 12 years, one in the UK, one in Europe, one in Australia, which have all conclusively shown that alcohol is the most harmful drug overall because of its pervasive impact on other people, right? So when it comes to cannabis, because the THC is fat soluble, which means it's stored in the fat tissues, it's released into the bloodstream slowly, people can still test positive for several days after.
Yes.
And testing positive for THC when you're behind the wheel of a car, well, that's a serious offence.
Mm.
So I think one of the issues is when we're looking at, you know, how, I guess, accepted these policies are, a lot of people, you know, look, for example, at the policy regarding cannabis and driving, and they think it's not evidence-based like alcohol is. And there are many drugs which we don't prohibit people driving under the influence of, which certainly increase the risk of having a car accident.
Mm.
Pain medication, for example.
Right.
Old generation antihistamines. So, and this is where it's really what the policy should be, is which drugs affect or impair people's ability to drive.
Mm.
What drugs, increase the risk of someone having a car accident and, you know, killing themselves or someone else or injuring.
Mm.
As such, yeah.
Right. And so what you're saying, studies have shown that when you've got alcohol is very high, when you've got THC, nowhere near as high. And so the fact that they're, because it's a pretty serious crime, isn't it, if you've got THC and you could have, you know, had a joint and then 3 days later it's still in your system, you feel completely fine, you're not impaired at all, but then you get random drug tests and bang.
Yeah, and it's also a massive issue with people who are dependent on cannabis.
Mm.
So people who are dependent on cannabis are obviously more likely to test positive behind the wheel of a car. The more they test positive, the less leniency they're going to get, and the harsher the punishments they're going to get, because obviously they're seen as a repeat offender. When really you're, you know, punishing someone who actually has a medical problem and who needs help, not handcuffs as such. Yeah,
yeah, and I've seen that a lot. You know, I know some people who are addicted to cannabis, and. Yeah. Because it's funny, because people, I think there's been this big thing like weed is harmless and all this stuff. But man, I've seen people in my life where it's like, it was harmless at first. But as I mentioned in the story earlier on, and then a year, 2 years, 3 years, I know people in my life who are like, I was stoned all 2019, the whole year. I think I was high the entire year. And, you know, he's like, he knows he has to get off it, but he can't. And yeah, so people are like, weed's not addictive. Well, it depends on the person and the scenario, but I think it can be very addictive. And, you know, and then in order to afford it, they start dealing. And then they get busted dealing, and it's just this ripple effect, which Brent talks about quite a bit, the ripple effect of, you know, getting into that world.
Creates a big problem is pyramid selling. So yes. Where, you know, someone is dependent on whatever drug it is, cocaine, heroin, cannabis, whatever, and then they need to fund that, so then they sell into dealers, and those dealers sell into other people. It creates sort of like a pyramid as such. Some people who are very pro-cannabis say you can't get addicted to cannabis. Mm. That's just simply not true.
I've seen it.
We know that about 1 in 10 people who ever try cannabis become dependent. It's slightly higher if you use under the age of 18, 1 in 6 to 1 in 7. I will say, however, that dependence is different to addiction.
Yes.
Dependence is where, I mean, a lot of people are dependent on caffeine. Mm. They get to work at 9 o'clock in the morning. They struggle through the first hour, they have a coffee, and then they're sweet as.
Yeah.
They're dependent on caffeine. The difference is when someone continues to use a drug despite severe adverse consequences to their life.
Mm.
So when someone is... And this is not only for drugs. I mean, it can be for other things as well. For example, gambling. So someone who's...
gambling's huge.
So someone, for example, who is continuing to gamble despite the fact that they've overdrawn their credit cards, despite the fact they're in debt already, despite the fact their family has noticed and told them to stop gambling.
I saw a video on an addiction expert.
Yep.
And he was like, what is the worst addiction you've ever seen? And he said, hands down, by a landslide, gambling. Mm. He said, I've dealt with people who have been gambling. They've lost their house, their wives, their kids. They've lost everything they could have imagined.
And they continue.
And they keep going. Yep. Because the worst thing that could happen to you is you go into, like, if you, let's say you're gambling for the first time, like, the worst thing that could happen is you hit the jackpot first go, because now you're going to be chasing that. I see it on TikTok, which might sound silly to you. You get a viral video and then you dip. You don't have a viral video for 2 months and you're constantly chasing that addiction of having followers come in and people commenting and stuff.
People get sensitized to that one hit. And of course, with regards to the social media aspect, you know, comments, likes, they all reinforce.
Mm. That ties in. That's dopamine hits. Oh, you only hit 200 likes instead of 400 likes this time. You feel disappointed. Yeah. Why?
And it's the same. And look, there are many. I mean, there are many addictions. People get addicted to shopping. They can get addicted to sex. I mean, and you know, someone being addicted to sex, just, you know, they've they're in an established relationship already, but they continue to have extra relational you know, connections as such.
Porn.
Yeah, exactly. Porn's, so. When someone does become addicted, you have the stimulus, and the stimulus could be, you know, something like a drug, or it could be something like gambling or shopping or whatever. But so there's that issue in itself, but then there's also the reasons why people are continuing to use it. If that makes sense. So it becomes more complex when people there is that reward system going on. You know, they are addicted to it because they gain tolerance, they get a diminished effect each time, you know, something with, for example, like a drug, like alcohol. But then there's the issues that have pushed them to drink in the first place. And that's where, you know, people's mental health needs to be addressed. Do they have issues at home with their family, at school, their job, all of those things that have happened in their their history as such.
And that's where they say, like, alcohol is a suppressant. And a lot of these drugs are suppressant, so you don't have to deal, or, like, you know, deal with your real emotions and how you're feeling.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of the greatest quotes that I've heard was from an artist called Frida Kahlo. She was a famous painter, and she said, "I tried to drown my sorrows, but the bastards learned how to swim."
Yeah.
So it's really tough, and it can be extremely difficult, you know, for young people watching one of their friends go through that, and you know, knowing. How do I respond to this person?
And so what advice do you give to young people? I mean, obviously there's so many scenarios we could run through, but like, I guess what is the most generic scenario, which might be alcohol, might be weed, whatever it is, when you talk in your workshops, how do young people navigate this world? Because it's just by this conversation, how many variables have we spoken about? How many different drugs? And we're just scratching the surface.
I think the most important question, and this could be a family member asking their child, it could be a, you know, a brother asking their brother, a sister asking their sister, whatever it is, a friend asking a friend. The most important question, I think, that you should ask someone if they are using a drug and you're concerned about them is why they're using. If someone says, "Look, I'm using cannabis because, you know, I enjoy getting high, or it's a bit of fun, or whatever." Now, we shouldn't be celebrating that. Not good. And we should certainly still try and work at getting the person off using cannabis, or, you know, using less, at least, as such, or whatever drug it is. But if the person turns around and says, "I'm using it because I hate my life," "I'm using it to cope," that's the moment where you need to drop everything and help that person, because that's really when things can spiral.
Do you think many people would say that to answer that question, or do you have to dig deeper to get that answer?
You may have to dig a little bit deeper. And I think if someone is going to talk to someone about their drug use, one of the first things they need to be aware of is that they may, this is where, you know, coming to talking to someone else, you know, so if you're looking after someone and trying to help them, it's important that you talk to someone else as well, because that can be a lot of weight on your shoulders, you know, hearing someone unload on you about, you know, how much they hate their life or whatever it is, right? So
that's why therapists legally have to have their own therapist.
Yeah, and supervision and things like that. Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing to realize is that you can do all you can to help that person, but it's not your responsibility as such. I mean, I certainly know from losing my best friend at school, when that happened, I basically felt as though that was my fault. What did I miss? What did I not do? You know, I still remember the last couple of things that she said to me on the few messages that she sent. And you think, why didn't I just say, "Are you okay? Can we meet up? You know, let me look out, like, just, you know, scoop you up and take care of you so that this doesn't happen as such." So I think the first thing for young people to realize is that if they're looking after someone else, they aren't responsible for someone else's behavior. Mm. It's very difficult for people to sort of, I guess, consider themselves often not responsible for it. And I think, like, I should have done more. What did I miss? What did I not say, etc. If they are going to talk to someone about it, it's really important they pick their time and place wisely. Mm. So not when they're under the influence of the drug,
right.
And in private. Not when they could be interrupted, overheard, when they have to rush off, all of those things. And obviously not when the person's under the influence of the drug, because, you know, your person might get confrontational, defensive. They probably won't soak everything that you're talking to them about, okay? Mm. I think that it's a good idea to start with something positive. So you could say to this person, you know, I love you, my closest friend, I still care about you.
Love sandwich technique. You know that, right? Yeah, so you just, you go, love, feedback, love.
Yeah.
So you sandwich your negative, well, not negative, but your constructive feedback with a bit of love just to soften it.
Yeah, and I think that because you still really care about the person.
Of course.
You want to look after them, you want to see change, you want to help them, but it's, you know, the behavior that you want to see change as such. Yeah. Before talking to the person, it's a good idea to gather resources, helplines, pamphlets. We don't really use pamphlets anymore, but, you know, websites. You know, I've looked it up, and look, this is the closest Headspace, you know, that you can go to, and, you know, this is the process that Headspace, or whatever organization it is. So I think that picking your time and place, having those resources already prior organized, having some evidence that, you know, if the person, you've been in situations where the person has, you know, passed out, or they've been really intoxicated, you know, I spent the whole night looking after you, or I'm really, you know, I was really worried about you, all those things.
So when they go, I'm fine, no, it's fine.
So,
no,
well, because actually you're not, because, you know, when you took LSD last weekend, you know, I was totally freaked out for, you know, those 6 to 8 hours. I didn't know how to look after you.
Just because you're fine, and you might think you're fine, but it's like, yeah, but then you ruin someone else's night because they're looking after you. Do you know how many people were looking after this kid the other night? Yep. It was a 45-minute round drive. It's like a 1.5-hour round trip. Yep. And he did it because he's a nice guy, and I was super grateful, and we called his mum and everything. But it was like a lot of people were looking after him.
Yep.
And, like, he's not a bad kid. I honestly don't know what happened. He just had a few too many drinks.
Yep.
It happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And but, you know, if it was happening regularly, it's like you don't want to be that person.
Yeah, and I think that in – and this certainly includes alcohol as well – not so much when you're, this is not in the situation of talking to someone, but when people are going out, it's really important that they look after one another and they don't leave one another alone.
Yeah.
I mean, I could, and this is not only a situation of, for example, someone dying. So someone passing out in a park, walking home by themselves, dying from hypothermia because they've drunk alcohol.
Wow.
You know, but, you know, putting someone, you know, telling them to sleep it off, but also in the context of things like sexual assault. So, and I could go through so many different situations. I mean, I could go through a personal situation of mine, for example, when I was out at a friend's birthday party, and I don't drink alcohol, but I was out at a friend's party. We went to this, we had this party at his particular house. Then we went out to the city afterwards, and I didn't really know many of the people at the party, but there was one of his friends who was there, who was a really, really nice girl. I just got to chatting to, because we shared some of the same interests. And then her and I left this particular bar that we were at, and she was very intoxicated. The reason why she left, because she said, I have to get some fresh air. So we went and got some fresh air. And in the time that we were out, you know, I guess by ourselves, her friends had left for the night, right? So this was a very intoxicated female with a male in the city, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. She has no way of getting home. Her only option to get home is basically for me to drive her home.
Yeah.
That's a really dangerous situation.
Yeah.
And of course, like, I drive her home. She's absolutely fine. Nothing.
But, I mean, obviously, it's a safe situation than that, but it could have been someone else.
Absolutely.
And the friends were making a very big gamble on you. And, you know, guys can put it on. They can act like nice guys for a night if they're trying to get with someone. Not to say, like, men are bad or anything. And I've obviously spoken for hours about this conversation with Brent. Yep. But I agree. It's like, it's crazy to me that they would leave her.
Yeah, and it's critical to look out for one another. to not go anywhere by yourself. And as I said, this is not just in the context of, you know, situations like that, but also, for example, where there have been individuals who have gone to a party drinking and they've said, oh, look, I'm just going to, you know, go for a walk. And they walk home, get lost, are found dead the next day in a park or a bus shelter or something like that because they've died from hypothermia, when really their mates should say, look, okay, mate, I'm going to go with you or no, stay here with us and we're going to leave together.
Yeah, I think it's really about being selfless. It's like, oh, he's going to go for a walk. I don't want to go for a walk. I'd rather stay here.
Yeah. The two biggest messages that I try and give to young people is, first of all, look after one another.
Mm.
And second of all, don't be afraid to call for help if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
I guess getting back to looking after a mate, because unquestionably one of the most challenging situations that young people could find themselves in is seeing someone go through those situations of where they are using a drug and they can't stop. And it's starting to also impact other areas of their life. You know, they're not turning up to school.
Yep.
They're rocking up to school and having, you know, red eyes. They're disengaging from sport, family, friends, all of those things. So that can be really, really tough. So other than those, I guess, those things that I mentioned, it's really important to follow through and follow up with the person, because we know that interventions as such don't work. You know, sitting someone down for an hour, you know, talking it through it, deep and meaningful, all those things, they're a bit hit and miss. It's really critical if that person is going to talk to someone, as I said, to pick their time and their place wise, all those things certainly matter, but to follow up with the person.
Yeah.
To, you know, check in with them constantly, to, you know, because it's one thing to say I care about you and want to look after the person and how to respond. It's another thing to actually, to actually follow through and help them through that process. Mm. When they're talking to them, their body language is really important. Crossing their arms, raising their chin, that's condescending, confrontational. Mm. Person's not going to respond to that.
Mm.
Even just repeating what the person has said to you back to them in a reworded fashion, that means that you're listening to them.
Yeah.
'Cause what will often happen is people will say, oh, look, the reason why I'm using cannabis is because, you know, like or alcohol, whatever drug it is because I'm just really struggling at school, or I've had this fight with my girlfriend, or whatever it is. And what a lot of people will say is, well, just stop using cannabis, or just break up with them, or whatever it is. And it's like, well, don't you think I've thought of that?
Yeah, yeah.
If you say to them, oh, mate, so I'm hearing that, you know, it's, you know, things are a bit tough with your girlfriend at the moment, or I'm hearing, you know, you're having a bit of trouble at school. The person straight away knows that you're listening to them. So simply repeating back to them what they said in a reworded fashion.
I mean, I sort of done a podcast almost. I've been interviewed on podcasts where they're just like, question, I answer, then they go, oh, that's awesome. Next question. And I was just like, are you guys even listening to me? Are you interested in what I'm saying? Or are you just listening off the questions?
Yeah.
It's the same, like I try comment on what you say or the guest. I'm like, to show that, you know, first of all, I think it makes it more engaging, but also it's like shows that I'm listening. It's like, oh, that's a good point, blah, blah, blah. It's the same when you're like giving that sort of stuff rather than, and I think a lot of people want to try to fix a problem, as you mentioned, we'll just get off cannabis, just break up with her. It's not that simple.
Yeah.
So I do think that's a really good tip.
And I think that also it's important to ask the person, look, what are you concerned about in terms of your drug use? Because for example, myself, if someone's drinking alcohol, I might be very concerned about their brain or their heart or their liver or whatever, but it's also important to ask them, look, okay, well, if I'm worried about what concerns you about, you know, your drug use, because, you know, it means that it gets you on their level as such. It establishes a connection, because as I said, look, and people are also very concerned about the physiological harms of certain drugs. They also need to be very aware of getting caught with them and how that can totally change their life in a really, really harmful way. In fact, a lot of people who don't actually get into physiological harms with illicit drugs, they can be certainly harmed by certainly being found in possession of those drugs. Criminal records, travel, insurance, bank loans, child custody, insurance, employment, all those things are massively affected by criminal records. People often have this, they think, oh, look, if I take this drug, I could overdose, or if I take this, you know, it damages my brain or whatever. That might be true, but don't lose sight of the fact that if it's an illicit drug, of how, you know, that can have a massive impact on your life.
Mm. Yeah. Isn't it like if you get a conviction, you can't go to America or something?
Every country is very, very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, every country is very, very different. They have different, it depends on, you know, what your conviction is. I mean, whether you're actually, whether you were actually convicted, depends on the severity, all of those things.
Yeah, and I mean, that's almost a whole other conversation within itself, the consequences of being caught with these drugs and the ramifications of that and how that can affect you and everyone around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And criminal records, they can have a disproportionate impact on someone's life. And a lot of things that young people want to engage in when they're finishing school, they want to travel, they want to get into university, they might want to move out. Well, you know, getting rental accommodation if you've got a criminal record can prove to be quite difficult.
Everything's just more difficult.
What is really sad is that society just does not see the person in the same light.
Mm.
They think criminal record, they can't see. It's almost the same as how we view drugs. We can't see a drug in the same light once it is illegal.
Right.
You know, people think, you know, it's harmful because it's illegal.
Yes. But then, as we mentioned, the legal drug, alcohol, is one of the biggest killers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think on the context of, I guess, looking, you know, talking to someone about it, if someone's using an illicit drug, they need to be aware of the consequences if they get caught with it.
Mm.
Of course, we're not, you know, we shouldn't be teaching people how to evade the police as such, but they just need to be aware. And this is why we've seen some deaths at music festivals, people being worried about sniffer dogs, police, and they down all their tablets.
Right.
And then they end up overdosing.
Yeah, and I mean, again, almost another conversation, festivals there that's been big in Australia. They're bringing like pill tests, or they bring it, people want them to bring in pill testing or something.
There's a big push for pill testing, but there's also a big push back against pill testing.
Mm.
And the sad thing is that to clarify
for listeners, sorry, pill testing is basically, isn't it just where like, okay, we know you're going to do drugs, rather than take potentially dangerous drugs, we're going to test the pills to make sure they're clean and they're not full of rat poison or whatever, so that you can do drugs safely. That's the concept?
Yeah, it's the concept. Look, there are a couple of different ways to do drug checking. So the first one is where people do it themselves. Mm. They buy, for example, they're colorimetric testing. So they put a small sample of their drug into a bag or a test tube or whatever it is, and it changes color. And then there's a color chart which will show you indicative of, you know, what's in there. The problem with that is that, first of all, it's not going to flag for everything. It's not going to, dictate how the person's going to respond. And also, one color could mean multiple different things. Mm. I mean, purple could mean MDMA, sure, but it could also mean all of these other things as well, which are much more toxic. Then we also have on-site pill testing. So this is where, or on-site drug checking, this is where someone goes to it could be, for example, a nightclub or a festival, and there is actually sanctioned drug checking at that particular site. This is where someone would provide a sample. That sample is tested, the sample is destroyed, and then the toxicologists and other people who are working for that particular facility provide feedback as to what their testing has found, and also some harm reduction advice. You know, yes, your pill contains MDMA, but it also contains a very high level of MDMA. So maybe if you're going to take it, of course, don't take it. But if you are going to take it, don't take the whole thing. Right. Take a quarter or half, and don't take more in a short period of time.
Right.
Make sure that you wait a couple of hours, drink, make sure that you stay hydrated. That you take breaks, all of those things, all that harm reduction advice. And then we also have off-site pill testing. So this is where someone would go to, you know, for example, they've got a festival coming up in, you know, 2 or 3 weeks' time, and they've got their ecstasy tablets, they might have 2 or 3 or whatever.
Mm.
They take it to an external facility where they actually get their pills tested. And then again, it works in a similar way in that, you know, you come back and they say, look, this is what is found in it.
Right.
And there are obviously advantages and disadvantages to each of those.
And is that external legal, or is that like a kind of underground?
Well, we don't have on-site or off-site pill testing in Australia.
Right.
Okay. Yes, there have been a couple of pilots, but in terms of actually providing a mechanism, we don't have that as of yet. There's been some movement in the last couple of months to push forward with it, but it doesn't actually exist at this point in time. There are many, many other countries which have, particularly in Europe. And there, as I said, there are advantages and disadvantages to each of those. So obviously the do-it-yourself ones are rudimentary. They're not nearly as accurate. They're not nearly as, I guess, extensive.
Mm.
as taking it to an offsite or onsite. Onsite is obviously convenient because people could just go to the festival and do it there. An offsite, they probably have better equipment. And certainly pill testing or drug checking, I should say, my personal opinion is that it certainly has a place in a suite of other harm reduction measures. And I mean, it has many potential benefits. Removing some really toxic chemicals, providing a warning system. So this was several years ago, where a number of people brought some pink Superman. I think it was pink Superman tablets. This is overseas, to a testing facility. Got them tested. They contained a very high level of a drug called PMA, paramethoxyamphetamine, which is very toxic, much more toxic than something like MDMA, which is the drug that ecstasy users want when they take ecstasy. Right. And throughout this particular country, there was warning, the social media warnings, public health alerts. Not a single death was recorded in that country. Wow. Now, it was either a few weeks or a few months later, those same pills were responsible for, it was either 4 or 5 deaths in the UK.
Right.
Because the UK decided against any, even though they were aware, they decided against any public warning system. Now, if there had been a warning system, people would have, you know, been supplied their pills and then gone, okay, I'm not taking that because I know that it's really, really toxic. Mm. So there's that issue. And also, people who often, this is generally, people talk about drug checking in the context of ecstasy, but it's, I mean, the problem, one of the real challenges with, I guess, drug checking with the people who do it, they're generally not a population who have spoken to professionals about their drug use. Mm. Drug checking will often be the first time they've actually had a real discussion about, you know, what they're taking.
Right.
You know, because they're often a high functioning group of people. They have jobs, they pay taxes, they, you know, they're in relationships. So they're not, for example, using drugs that are causing significant damage to their life where they may have had some, you know, connection with treatment facilities. They're often, you know, people going to music festivals. Yep. They often come from middle to high income families. So they don't see as though what they're using is a problem. So the first time they actually talk to a toxicologist at a music festival or a nightclub or whatever, that's often the first time they've actually had a discussion about their drug use,
right,
which is really, really good because, you know they're basically just in the dark before that, but now they're actually having a discussion as to, well, this is actually what you're taking. These are the effects. This is how you can mitigate the effects. And it might actually be the last time that they, the last chance they get to actually not take the drug.
Mm.
Because we know that, for example, sniffer dogs, police, they often don't deter people from taking drugs. They will, you know, encourage people to down their tablets.
Yeah.
And really the question we need to ask, like everything in public health, is what are we trying to achieve?
I'd say ultimately it's just preventing deaths, isn't it?
Ultimately we want to reduce harm among everyone.
And so whatever way to do that is the best way to do it.
And look, some people say, look, pill testing will, or drug checking will increase the number of people who use drugs. We don't know that for certain. I don't think that there is any strong evidence which would indicate that.
Mm.
But even if it did increase the total number of people, you're going to reduce harms because there's going to be a mechanism in place to provide people with harm reduction advice and maybe actually discourage them from taking them in the first place.
Mm. Yeah. And so ultimately you think, I mean, you can't just say yes or no, can you? Because there's so many variables. But there are a lot of benefits to pill testing.
Yeah, there are certainly merits to it.
Yeah,
I
think it's just such an Australian way to be like, oh, let's get the sniffer dogs, the police. It's like it's to me such an old school way of don't do drugs. No, just bad, bad, bad. It's like it doesn't work.
Yeah,
it's look, like stop smoking.
Yeah, and sniffer dogs. I'm not saying sniffer dogs have no role. I mean, there is, you know, there's evidence to say that sniffer dogs, you know, they sit down and indicate there is drugs when there's not drugs.
Right.
They don't sit down when there are drugs. So it's, you know,
it's not
the evidence is pretty poor regarding the, I guess, the efficacy of sniffer dogs.
Mm. But I guess it's more of a psychological thing.
Well, I think, scary. I'm not saying that sniffer dogs have no role. They may have a role, for example, at the airport, you know, sniffing out bags and things like that. But I mean, really, The aim of having sniffer dogs supposedly or a police presence is to make people think there are going to be police there. There's going to be sniffer dogs. I better not take these drugs.
That's what I mean. Like the psychological. Oh my god, I'm at a high risk because there's a sniffer dog there, and I can't get past a dog or whatever.
Yeah.
No matter how reliable it is, it does. I think it puts that second But as you mentioned, they either go, oh, I'm not going to do it, or I'm going to have to find a way to get around it, which is where it gets dangerous.
Yeah, and finding a way to get around it can be really dangerous. Yeah. People internally concealing them.
Yeah.
Or people taking all of them in fear of the police. Yeah. And again, that gets back to what are we trying to achieve? We're trying to stop people dying and stop people being hospitalized. But if people are downing them in haste or, you know, their packaging, which they're internally concealing, ruptures, then that's going to increase deaths and harm. That's not what we want. Mm. We're trying to protect people as such.
That's it. And that's where it's just, I mean, the government's been a bit interesting for the past 2 years with COVID. It's been just crazy times in general.
Yep.
But it doesn't feel like the government is wanting that goal.
Yep.
As a young person.
Yeah, and look, there's a...
And maybe, I could be wrong, but that's just I think, how it feels. And I think a lot of young people would go, yeah, the government, they don't care about preventing deaths. They just want to put this message out here of it's bad.
There's a couple of things. One of the things that I've heard constantly is there's no such thing as a safe illegal drug.
Mm.
Technically, there's no such thing as a safe drug, period, because all drugs carry risks. The other thing is...
But driving also carry risks.
Getting out of bed in the morning carries risks. Exactly. No one gets out of life alive, unfortunately. But if our standard for allowing the public regulated access to a drug, or even just providing them information on a drug, was the fact that it's not safe, we wouldn't provide the public access to any drug because, you know, antidepressants carry risks, antibiotics carry risks, painkilling medication, they all carry risk, but it's about balancing the benefits versus the harms. And on the note of there's no such thing as a safe illegal drug, true, but they are made much more dangerous when they are illegal because they are not regulated. Mm. I mean, alcohol, as we've gone through, certainly causes harm, significant harm. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's, you know, it's widely advertised and it's socially expected, all those things. But at least when someone goes to a bottle shop, they know it has, you know, if it's a bottle of vodka, it says 25 standard drinks.
Yep.
It's 25 standard drinks. It's not 5 standard drinks or 45 standard drinks.
Which is the whole issue with the MDMA we were saying. You might have a pill. It's like, oh, take 2. That'll get you buzzing. It depends on the strength of the pill.
There's no such thing as a low dose when people have no idea what they're taking.
Exactly, because it's not through, because there's no regulation, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and look, with alcohol, for example, someone could go into a bottle shop. They know that what they're getting is ethanol, which is what people can, you know, consume. But if someone were to, you know, it wasn't regulated and they were to drink methanol, which is a toxic form of alcohol.
Right.
I mean, 10 grams in Australia is a standard drink of alcohol, right? And 10 grams for the vast majority of the adult population probably would produce negligible intoxicating effects, right? 5 grams of methanol would cause blindness, organ failure in the vast majority of people. So it's much more toxic, but we don't have methanol in alcoholic products because it's regulated.
Yes, gotcha.
So yes, of course, MDMA has risks, but people think, oh, look, I have this pill, it's circular, it's yellow, it has a picture of an apple on it or whatever. There's no guarantee that that circular yellow pill with an apple on it is not the same as another circular pill with an apple on it.
Mm.
Because just because it looks the same, you know, same color, except that doesn't mean it's because there's no regulation.
Yeah.
So of course, as I said, MDMA is not safe, but taking ecstasy is much more dangerous when it's not regulated.
And this is where I think this conversation needs to be being said a lot more in government. And because as you mentioned, everything we're saying this entire episode goes back to what is the ultimate goal? To prevent deaths, to prevent harm from people in whatever way. If that's the ultimate goal, how can we best do that? And it doesn't have to be just, you know, us two giving our opinions or you. It's based in science, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
It's like you're pulling out stats and science that's been done. And as you mentioned, it's very hard to get science across because it has to be shown in a large amount and you can't get that across in a headline.
Yeah, people want certainty. Yeah. They want, for example, will having drug checking increase the number of people who use drugs?
Yes,
we can't say no.
Mm.
And we can't say yes.
Yeah.
Because it's difficult to say. You'll do some populations and they'll show that there is. They'll do some populations say there's none. And then they'll do some which, you know, there's been no increase at all.
Mm.
And there'll be some populations where there's a decrease. So there's no certainties, but people want yes, no.
Yeah.
And as I said before, it's intellectually dishonest to say, no, it will not increase drug use.
Mm.
Because, you know, in some populations it might, but in other populations it might
There's not. Just way too many variables in all this stuff. But I mean, look, this has been super interesting. I think this has been a great episode. Thank you so much for coming on. Before I wrap up, I've always got one final question. I really love episodes. I want to do more episodes like this that are like niche topics.
Yep.
I've been doing a lot of episodes which are kind of just like about their life, and I think they're really good and motivating. But I love, like, with you and Brent, it's like sexual assault, drugs and alcohol. Like, I love going niche because it means we can really dig deep and get into that. So I appreciate you coming on. Now, obviously, you're speaking at schools and stuff. I'm sure people will reach out to you. But before we get into all that, I'd love to just know, what would your number one piece of advice be to the younger generation? It does not have to be drug or alcohol related when it comes to anything. What would, like, if you're like an 18-year-old?
Could I have like 10 seconds?
Dude, take your time. Everyone, it's a big question.
And it doesn't have to be drug related.
Whatever you want.
Gee, that's a really tough one. That's a really tough one. I get, if it was drug related, I'd say look after your mates. Don't be afraid to call for help if something goes wrong. In general, to an 18-year-old who's finishing school, you know, they've got the whole world in front of them. I think that this is going to sound really generic and cliched, but I remember a really, really good quote actually from the actor Jim Carrey. He said, "You can fail at what you don't want, at what you don't enjoy and what you hate, right? You can fail at that. So you might as well take a chance and do something that you love."
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, I remember when I was at school, I didn't do public speaking. I was so terrified of public speaking. I didn't do public speaking, and I really had no idea what I wanted to do. But when you find something that you're just really passionate about, and that you love doing, I think you've got it made.
Yeah.
And I think that really is the great challenge, is to find what you really, really love and just chase that passion. I mean, I realize that we live in the real world and we have to pay bills and all that sort of stuff. I get that. I totally get that. But I think that, you know, finding that passion or reigniting that passion, and chasing what you love to do and taking a chance, I think that's really what, when people, particularly when they're leaving school, they're going out into the real world as such. I think that's probably my best piece of advice, is that pursue something that you love doing.
And the cool thing about the world is today you can pursue whatever you want and find a way to make money through social media, through all these different avenues, which is so exciting to me because other generations has never had that opportunity.
Yep.
And so I love the Jim Carrey quote. He's talking about his father who wanted to be a comedian, became an accountant.
Yeah.
And then he saw, you know, they were struggling. His father lost his job and he failed as an accountant.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't, I think I'd probably generally be the last person to quote Jim Carrey because he's got a lot of views that I don't agree with.
Yes,
right. You know,
but I mean, it doesn't, if you, but you agree with what he said.
But I do agree certainly with the fact that, you know, and I know people who have worked for so long in their industry and they think, man, if I had my time again, look, I really just love working with young people, or I love doing this. I wish I had have done that.
Yeah.
I think that pursuing something that you really, really love.
Absolutely. And that's what this podcast is all about. So you hit the nail on the head. But Tom, if people want to get into contact with you, have you come to your school? I know you've been booked out because of COVID. You're back in. You're talking about all this stuff. Where's the best place to go?
You can just contact me via the website.
Yep.
So www. It's a bit of a tricky one. INDDEA.com.au.
Yep. And I'll put the link in the show notes so you don't have to memorize it. Just go down and click that. Contact Tom. Feel free to message him. Message me as well. I think it's been a great episode. But Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, mate.